The Tom Woods Show, episode 2314.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. The great Jeff Deist is back with us today. And the thing that you have longed for now exists. That is to say, a book by Jeff Deist. We're going to be talking about that today, called A Strange Liberty, Politics Drops Its Pretenses. But before we do that, I'll just mention that Jeff, for, I don't know if it was 9 or 10 years, was president of the Mises Institute, but he has moved on to something else. Maybe you want to say something about that?
Yes, it's hard to believe, but after 10 years, I've moved on to be general counsel for a company in the metals and mining area. So that's going to be an interesting change for me.
Well, I am sad to see you go. You were an incredibly effective president of the Mises Institute. The initiatives that can be traced to you are excellent. You were almost an irreplaceable spokesman for the Mises Institute. I think maybe one of the greatest assets the Institute has ever had. I don't say that lightly. So it makes me very sad to see you no longer at the helm, but I'm glad that you have something that is good for you and will challenge you and moves you into the next phase of your life. So congratulations to you, but a great loss for the rest of us.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Tom, for those kind words.
Oh, I could multiply them by 1,000, but then this would turn into a conversation with Gene Epstein. Like, we never get to the subject matter, so let's not do that. I reserve that only for my episodes with Gene Epstein. Let's talk about your book. I have long felt that we needed to have a full-length Jeff Deist book, and now we've got it. Of course, I'm linking to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/2314. And as I was reading through it, I thought to myself that so many of the themes you're raising have been, if anything, only amplified since you initially wrote them. So, for example, you talk in here about post-persuasion America, and you talk about, what is it, David French, I think, is he the New York Times, quote-unquote conservative, who... Because you talk about the raid on Mar-a-Lago, and you reproduce his tweets on it.
Well, you know, if the DOJ acted inappropriately, we should get to the bottom of it, but we have a rule of law. But,
and of course, completely missing what's actually happening in society. So that whole analysis could be applied to the indictment of Trump, too.
Well, we're just following the legal procedures.
Yeah, that's a conservative, quote unquote, who just likes having the boot on his neck.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of the themes in this anthology ring truer today, to the point where you almost wonder, were we naive just 10 years ago, for example? The idea that politics has dropped its pretenses is sort of a unifying theme throughout. I mean, I touch on economics. I get into the immigration and borders debate where I try to present a few different sides. I get into some cultural questions. I get into a lot of economics, central banking, fiat money questions. I certainly get into some political economy as well. But what strikes me is just how much things have changed since, let's say, 2015, which is almost a decade ago now. And the idea that politicians at least used to attempt to tell us that they cared about us and they represented everyone, not just their particular constituencies or their voters, for example. And politics had a pretense that it wasn't that long ago, certainly within the lifetime of people alive today, where, for example, you might go into someone's home, Tom, and see a portrait of JFK above the fireplace. Now, this is not to say that there was ever a golden age of politics or that politics was not always corrupt or that people like FDR and JFK and historical figures weren't hated in the same way I suppose Trump and Biden are hated. But I will say this, amongst normies, let's just say, if you went into someone's home today and saw a picture of Joe Biden hanging above the fireplace mantle, you would probably suggest that they seek some sort of professional counsel or something, right? I mean, that would just seem absurd to you. So that's a pretty significant shift in just a couple of generations. But more importantly, just since Trump and Brexit, let's just say, came on the scene around 2015, the shift has been pretty profound, where now we have politicians who are very open about basically wanting to vanquish the other side. Now, what the other side means, we have left and right, we have conservative and liberal, we have red state and blue state just in the U.S., but it's a little more than that. It's more than just, let's say, people who didn't vote for them or whatever. I mean, politicians now will come along and say, we're going to have X, Y, and Z, and if you don't like it, you're a bad person. You know, you're a racist or a retrograde or deplorable or whatever it might be. And I would say that the rhetoric has changed just in that period. In other words, there's no more pretense of trying to appeal to everyone. There's no more subterfuge that, hey, look, this is the democratic process. We sort of duke it out, and whoever gets the most votes wins. And neither the far left nor the far right get everything they wanted, but that's good because they're crazy. And we get this sort of down-the-middle government that just represents a democratic consensus. And of course, democracy represents a form of consent and thus legitimacy. And gee whiz, even with all of its hard edges, democracy really is the best thing going. Well, no, they've thrown that pretense out the window. Now they just say, you know, if Trump wins, it's not legitimate. There's no way Hillary Clinton couldn't have won. And if she didn't, it's not legitimate. Viktor Orban is not the legitimate leader of Hungary because he's a fascist or something. Well, Viktor Orban won a couple elections pretty handily. You know, Brexit, which everyone's trying to undo, had huge voter turnout, over 70% voter turnout. And imagine 70% voter turnout in the U.S., by the way. But amongst that turnout, it was a pretty good margin, something on the order of 55-ish, 45-ish in favor of Brexit. Folks, that's democratic. And you don't just get to change that by calling it fascist or whatever it might be. So I was just struck by the change in just the last few years during my time at the Mises Institute in this rhetorical posture. And I think we ought to recognize that. And so if there's any overall message or tone or thrust to the book, it is that politics isn't working. It really can't work in any kind of country this large on a mass scale. In other words, in national elections. And we need to be thinking about how we're going to replace it. Because if we do nothing, I really think that politicians will attempt to vanquish us.
That is more or less where things appear to stand right now. And it's strange being somebody of, let's say, roughly your age and my age, that we've lived to observe this, the beginning of this, whereas during our lifetimes, it wasn't always this way. I keep using the example of the 1980s, but yeah, I remember when I was 12 years old in 1984, I didn't like Walter Mondale and I liked Ronald Reagan, but I didn't feel like Walter Mondale was completely at war with every civilized standard of life and wanted to shove a foreign ideology down my throat 24 hours a day. I didn't have that feeling. Suddenly now this has happened. I wonder how we even trace out who and when and how and why.
Well, so let's just say Walter Mondale did not pose an existential threat to the Woods family.
No, he did not.
And that's interesting.
Partly because of his own ineptness, right? Ineptitude.
Well, and look, there was some real vitriol for Richard Nixon. Deep hatred on the left and in the media. There was real hatred and vitriol for Ronald Reagan. There was real hatred for Bill Clinton. No question about it. So we shouldn't sugarcoat things too much about the past, but on a superficial level, there's been a shift, and not just amongst the politicians. For example, Biden's speech in front of those sort of red backdrops that made him look like some kind of Bond villain. I mean, that was not a consensus-building speech. That was not a reach across to the deplorable speech. That was a speech that basically conveyed, we're in charge now, and you better get used to it. But it's not just the politicians, it's also the media posture. We can't forget that the media is in bed with the political class, and that's why they promote as right-wingers David French or Mary Cheney or Mitt Romney or Asa Hutchinson, whatever it might be, as opposed to Pat Buchanan or Paul Gottfried or someone worthy. And as a result of all this, there's certainly been a populist animus in this country, which has risen and I think is still rising. We find out even today, I know this will air next week, but what's going on in France in terms of their populist uprising against the raising of the pension age has really turned violent. They apparently invaded some BlackRock offices. And we have this idea that the French are a fete snobs, but apparently they're also populist guillotiners. So I don't know how you reconcile those two things. And so the media has stopped pretending, and the media is basically sneering at us. And as a result, a lot of Americans, I think, are becoming radicalized. And let's not forget COVID. My gosh, COVID was just an absolutely, it was a gulf. It was a sea change, I think, in the American landscape. And I guess what gives me hope and gives me pleasure about what's happening is that it's a little less ideological. It's not so much along the same old partisan lines that we've suffered under. We don't have to listen to National Review boomer constitutionalism anymore as the alternative to Hillary Clinton or whatever it might be. So that's nice. It's nice that people have woken up to some real alternatives. And I think more importantly, it gives us a sense that younger people see politics as hopeless and perhaps don't want or can understand our message that politics ought not to be the central organizing principle in society. We have all kinds of things like marketplaces and families and all kinds of intermediary institutions and everything from religion on down to represent order in society, to represent an organizing principle. And so if we can create some generations that are, I don't necessarily want to use the term jaded towards life, but jaded towards politics, I think that's a good thing.
Let me return to the issue in the news these days, which is the Trump indictment. I cannot tell you how little patience I have for, I just ignore, I don't know how big of a chunk of the libertarian world it is, but it's a chunk of people who are excited to see him in court. We're going to stick it to him. How short-sighted can you possibly be? What he's being accused of is all fake, quote-unquote, crimes anyway. Even if it were legitimate, even if it weren't the same crime, alleged crime, repeated 34 times, it's total BS. But everybody who isn't a complete moron knows that this is politically and ideologically driven. This is not a matter of this man is a menace because of this thing he did. Everybody knows that's what's going on. And we've got libertarians who somehow feel like the rule of law is being upheld. So I don't listen to those people because they can't see 5 inches in front of their face. I don't know. Their analysis is terrible. But on the other hand, we have people, let's say black-pilled people on the hard right, who are now looking at American life and saying, for a long time, people calling themselves libertarians have said, we believe in certain principles, abstract principles that apply to everybody, and we'd show no favoritism to any individual or creed or cause or anything. And we believe in our principles. The other side doesn't really have that. The other side's principle, quote unquote, is we're going to crush and, as you say, vanquish our opponents. So if one side says we're going to crush and vanquish our opponents, and the other side says we're going to stick to the implementation of impartial principles, it's not difficult to see which side wins. So is there a part of you, Jeff Dice, that thinks at this point, well, if they're going to weaponize the legal system against, obviously not just Trump, it's coming to your neighborhood next, maybe we have to weaponize it against them. Have we reached that point? Or is there a more white-pilled way to look at the situation?
Well, it's a tough question. If we go back and read really two books, which are a blueprint for how to build a society, which is Nation State and Economy by Mises, and then a little bit later, Liberalism by Mises, both basically interwar years books, 1919, 1926, 27, if memory serves. I mean, that's all you need. That's all any government anywhere on earth needs to basically understand how to organize society. But nonetheless, that blueprint has been available since at least the late 1800s, what we would call real liberalism. And two things are abundantly clear today. One is that real liberalism, the kind Mises envisioned, has never been fully implemented. Number two, where it has been partially implemented, it didn't hold. So that's where we are today. We live in a very illiberal political landscape. And so the question becomes, how do you fight it? Well, Mises had some thoughts about Italian fascism. Hayek had some thoughts about Argentine fascism. I mean, the question becomes, how do you fight back? I don't really love this idea that, well, we need to seize the national apparatus and just jail the Democrats because they do that to us. That strikes me as fanciful. So I really think that the idea here is one of separation more than persuasion. 30 years ago, if you wanted to learn about Austrian economics, for example, you had to make the effort to even have heard about Austrian economics, go out, maybe purchase some books, source some books, your local or public or school library wouldn't have had much, if anything. But whereas today, we really don't have the information excuse that maybe our grandparents had. In other words, the arguments are out there. The information's out there. If people were to be persuaded, they probably would be more persuaded by now. So I really think that this idea of subsidiarity, of decentralizing things, is the path forward. Now, a lot of people on the left don't want to hear that because they think that they're routing the place and that they're going to win everywhere. So why should they give up a single state, a single town, whatever, to these deplorables? But I'm not so sure that the route is going to come as quickly as they think it might. And so there's a selling point to the left to say, hey, look, you can have a lot more of what you want right here and right now if you're just willing to do it on a more subsidiary level and apply a bit more federalism. And as for libertarians talking about this, I mean, this isn't the rule of law. You mentioned that everyone views this as political and trumped up. I think that's a good thing. I think that's the result of people like Tom Woods working out there in the wilds all these years, that people naturally now have this sort of cynicism towards it. We don't have this aw shucks Andy Griffith view of government. I think that's probably healthy. And it wasn't that long ago. Just go back to the early 2000s when George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and John Ashcroft and John Yoo were ascendant, and they were talking about the unitary executive, and they were talking about renditions, and they were having Guantanamo Bay, and we don't need a declaration of war to go into Iraq, and all these kinds of things. I mean, it's during this period, again, in a recent memory, Lou Rockwell wrote his book, Red State Fascism, just to describe this. So you fast forward to today, 20 years later, let's say, and we have terrible blue state fascism. We're really shocked and surprised, I think. Even those of us who are pretty jaundiced about politics, we're pretty shocked and surprised by the degree to which open fascism, a corporate and state melding, a partnership, has unrolled in front of us. And so I think libertarians today, for the most part, are neutered because they simply fail to accept or understand that the left is far worse than the right, both in terms of what it actually believes and in its power and ability to impose those beliefs, not just across government, but corporate America, mainline religious denominations, advertising, culturally, the arts, major media, all the colleges. So people who don't want to recognize the war in front of them or the fight in front of them, it's sort of like, you know, the battle of the Somme is raging, but we want to be down in Morocco fighting in the desert. Well, that's not where the battle is. The battle is where it is. And honestly, in terms of guerrilla warfare, in terms of we're outmatched and outdone by the, call them political or cultural elites, the guerrilla warfare is occurring on the cheap, I would argue, in places like this podcast.
That's what I'm shooting for. That's what I'm shooting for. Would you say, I think I know the answer, but would you say, and this is not meant to be just a yes or no question, that the way you think about the kinds of issues you talk about in the book has changed over the past, say, 10 years? And if so, how and why?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that ANCAP, anarcho-capitalism conversation, really animates people anymore. That was a big deal in, let's say, 2005 to maybe 2012, 2013 in there. It was around that time of two Ron Paul campaigns, everything. And of course, back then, people still used forums on websites at Mises.org, for example. There was a lot more blogging back then. That's not really where people duke it out anymore. That takes place on social media platforms today. But that issue no longer animates me. I think we've probably beaten that to death, the idea of talking about or the what ifs behind, hey, what if we could actually privatize the courts and justice system? What if we could privatize police services? What if we could privatize so-called national defense? I mean, those were all very interesting questions to me anyway, 10 or 15 years ago. And I think those are not so serious anymore because now we're facing more existential stuff like, hey, how do I keep my kids away from it? This is me personally, this trans mania, which I don't care to have my children involved in. Really deeper questions. How do I keep my family together? How do I keep my finances together? How do we make sure that the rising criminality in this country isn't affecting us? Whatever it might be. Should my kids even go to college? I mean, I probably wouldn't have even thought that way 10 years ago. So yes, that's changed. And also my perception of public versus private has changed. It's not the neat distinction it once was, where I would have said, oh, you know, don't worry about Google. Yeah, they don't have any power over you. You don't even have to use Google search or Gmail, but that local cop in your town, if he's in a bad mood, he can pull you over because your brake light's out and you're going to get a ticket. And if you protest and don't accept a ticket, he's going to tase you and take you off to jail. So what you really have to worry about is the state, and Google would be nothing without the state. Yeah, I think there's still some truth to that, but I think this, again, melding of corporate and political power is maybe something we didn't anticipate, and that we have to admit that we were somewhat wrong, that basically this clear-cut, bright-line distinction between public and private is not as clear and bright-line as it once was.
Yes, and we need to do more work on that. We need to reckon with that more. I completely agree. I was happy to see in this book, again, we're talking about your book, A Strange Liberty, your discussion of the elites and that we have the wrong elites. Like, there's nothing wrong per se with the phenomenon of elites. We just have the wrong ones. We have ones that are so wrong, though, it almost discredits the very idea of elites. Like, how did this ever happen? And not just in politics, like across all of society. How frequently do you run into somebody who is presented to us as someone to admire and emulate, who is genuinely intelligent, well-read, well-spoken, morally beyond reproach, admirable in his personal conduct? Never?
I mean, the people I know might fit in that category of natural elites are quite old today, to be fair. And yes, we absolutely need elites. Michael Malice makes this point that elite rule is inevitable. Right? The 80-20 rule applies to everything in life. And there are always going to be people who, either by intelligence or will or a general likability or even station at birth, people don't want to hear that, whatever it might be, would form a natural elite in society. But we've perverted that heavily by basically subsidizing and propping up the wrong elites and actually punishing and damping down or even sometimes criminalizing the good or natural elites. So that's a real problem, no question about it. And I think that we just need to understand that the kind of old fuddy-duddy conservative idea of a merit-based society, a meritocracy, that we're going to have this kind of neoliberal capitalism and really smart people who somehow go to Stanford or Wharton are going to run everything. And it's not going to be these old hereditary people or, you know, it's not going to matter anymore. Well, yeah, it is going to matter because as we've seen, I mean, access to elite colleges, for example, now is completely politicized. Lots of bright kids are who happen to be white or Asian are just not getting in. So it's a problem, but we shouldn't fear the idea of elitism, in my view, but we should definitely oppose the idea of unnatural elites because that's pretty scary. And I think real elites or would be real elites are pretty cowed right now. I think they're very worried and it's probably easier to just keep your head down and not challenge the political status quo because let's say you're very wealthy, you don't want to lose that position in society. You don't want to do anything to endanger your children or grandchildren and their position in society. So it's a lot easier to just sort of go along and sort of say, well, yeah, you know, trans women or women or whatever it might be.
Yeah. And there's something that's just weirdly unreal about America today, maybe in much of the West, but it seems worse in America. There's something weirdly unreal about the place that there are certain propositions that we are expected to repeat and believe that are just not true. And I'm not completely convinced that the people trying to convince us of them even fully believe them, but we're expected to believe them. And then the alleged experts who dictate our lives, so let's take public health, are telling us things that are just belied by any glance at the charts and graphs. So all during COVID, charts and graphs are clearly contradicting them. Like when the mask mandate was lifted from airplanes, you would think if that made a real difference, we would see it in the data. We would see a big blip. There's no blip. Of course there isn't. Or the monetary authorities. And here I get back to Brooklyn because your book has a COVID section and also has a monetary policy section. The people running monetary policy like to give the impression that they're just carrying out the scientific demands of economics. And unless you have a degree in that, you're not qualified to comment on it. Just leave the experts to it. But there's something weirdly fake about all this. It's like they're making it up as they go along. The finances of the U.S. are entirely fake. The country is fake. The culture is fake. The whole thing is fake. I don't think there's even a question in there.
No, it's really something. When you look at the politicization of everything, so a college president, for example, today can be an absolute clown. U.S. senators, it wasn't that long ago that there was a real distinct difference between a U.S. representative and a U.S. senator. Generally speaking, the latter came from wealthier families. They had more of an Ivy League pedigree. they tended to be older and they had more accomplishments or at least money in life. And look, if you're going to be a U.S. Senate, there's only 100 of those on earth. You ought to be in the top 1% of Americans in terms of intelligence, ability, achievement. You should be a truly impressive person. And that would probably argue for someone, you know, at least 40, just to build up the time to be an impressive person with a lot of achievements and accomplishments. And yet, when you look at U.S. senators today, people will say, well, AOC should run for Senate, or anyone could be a senator today. And a lot more people who used to be in the House are senators. That's not the way it used to be. Now, federal judges used to be an absolute cut above state and local judges. Again, more Ivy League degrees, generally more intelligent, better read. There was a real difference. Being a federal judge was something. And oftentimes, you know, it's not the highest paying job. So oftentimes they had been very successful materially in their lawyer lives that allowed them or enabled them to accept being a federal judge. That has changed now. We have absolute hacks, just unbelievably dumb people being appointed by presidential administrations for the most hackish of reasons. I mean, some of these new crop of Biden judges are just unbelievable. I mean, people who, as we see in hearings and testimony, and also appointees to various agencies and departments who don't even have a baseline understanding of the subject matter of their own, let's say, court's jurisdiction. I mean, it's really something, this naked political patronage. And it goes, again, to your point of just how unserious everything feels today. And that, I think, is real. It's hard to put into words, but I think a lot of Americans do sense that.
It is hard to have optimism about the future because of all the crazy things they've gotten away with. At the same time, you think maybe a backlash will come. It is probably inevitable. But I don't know, there are just so many bad trends that I see that my natural, amiable, optimistic outlook is challenged at a time like this. At the same time, I try to remind my mailing list that the public health, and not just public health, but the ruling regimes of the world wanted to impose a systemic vaccine passport system, and they could not make it stick. Even the most defiantly anti-science places like New York could not make it stick. And so we need to be, you know, sometimes we have to be consoled that, yes, even though we have no big names, we're despised, we're unpopular, we accomplish that by being refuseniks. And so there is that. There are more of us than maybe we think.
Yes, and energized in ways that perhaps people were not before 2015, and certainly before 2020 and COVID. So if it takes something like COVID to energize people and wake them up, well, that's a lot better than a Great Depression or a Civil War or all kinds of horrific things that many of our grandparents or great-grandparents or someone else lived through. So we don't have the right or the luxury to be pessimistic, I think, because we haven't had it hard enough in our own material lives. We haven't had it hard enough to deserve that. In other words, we don't deserve to be pessimistic. We haven't earned that. If someone will live through the Great Depression and then they were really cranky and pessimistic the rest of their life, be like, yeah, okay. But those of us who have mobile devices in our pocket, the size of a slim deck of cards that has all of human knowledge ever and history ever known, I would argue we don't have the right to complain first and foremost. And I do think there's a lot of great populist trend lines we could be watching coming out of COVID. I think the idea of Tucker Carlson having such a big audience, don't always agree with him, often do. But nonetheless, that's not really an easily identifiable left or right paradigm there. I think RFK Jr. running for president is a wonderful development. I was talking to a friend the other day at lunch, and I said, well, he asked me what I think about RFK Jr. I got to meet him once at a Ron Paul thing where there was a reception. He kind of came in with these two Secret Service looking guys and everything. So that was kind of neat. And he's, you know, he's a tall guy. He's got a little bit of a voice throat problem, which makes it hard to listen to him speak at the beginning, but then it warms up. But he's got that Kennedy stature, Kennedy name. And I just said to my friend, I said, here's what I do know is RFK Jr. doesn't hate my guts and wish me ill, right? I mean,
yeah.
Our political calculations have to change. That's the same way I thought about Tulsi Gabbard and everyone, you know, like, oh, Jeff, she's some gun grabber. Well, I'm sure she is. She was in the CFR, she went to Davos, whatever it might be. But I mean, that's how bad politics have gotten. The first question we have to ask ourselves is that Leninist, you know, does this person hate my guts? And I think a lot of people looked at Trump and said, Yeah, no, he doesn't. And a lot of people looked at Hillary Clinton and said, damn right, she does hate my guts. And so sometimes we overthink politics. We think, you know, about candidates and policies and personnel and all this other stuff. But boy, oh boy, at this point in American political life, I think it's come down to something a lot more visceral, Tom.
Well, as long as you brought him up, let's just say a quick word. What do you think about this RFK Jr. possibility?
Well, you know, look, he's got some personal wealth from his family, and that's fine. And that helps to insulate him from some of the rough parts of being an iconoclast or an outcast in the way he's been. But he has paid a heavy price. His wife is a Hollywood actress. The circles he's always traveled in his entire life as a liberal transported to the West Coast, and I mean a liberal in the Kennedy sense of that, he's really paid a personal price. And I think a lot of people who were friends of his for a long time and friends of his family really turned on him. So we first should note his courage in doing this. He could have lived quite comfortably the rest of his life in a beautiful home, beautiful wife, all that kind of stuff. So he didn't have to do this. So first and foremost, I don't want to go too deep into swallowing the Kennedy mystique, but there is a sort of an element to this where he could have just been quiet and enjoyed life. So I think that's important. Also, I read his book that contained a lot about his father, but also his uncle, JFK. And obviously, as a biographical sketch, he's going to be biased in favor of his own uncle. But nonetheless, I learned quite a bit about some of his uncle's courage in facing down really an uprising in his own administration. When he had some back channels to Khrushchev, thankfully, that helped keep us out of a nuclear exchange, perhaps over the Bay of Pigs or Cuba. He had his own joint chiefs. He had his own DOD and Pentagon. He had his own vice president. And he certainly had his own secretary of state basically engaged, not quite in a coup, but actively working to undermine him. What does that remind you of? Donald Trump. If you read Bob Woodward's book, Fear, you will find all kinds of examples of his own administration undermining him. So I do think there's something to that. And again, things have devolved so badly that I would hope that most libertarian types would say, look, an old-fashioned Kennedy liberal is a hell of an improvement on what we've got.
That's how I am thinking about it. I mean, if I look at his whole, let's say if he released a platform, you're right, I would probably roll my eyes at 75% of it. Fair enough. But the 25% is really where the rubber meets the road, because he's been, not only was he good on COVID, and he was vindicated time and again, and the things that he was warning about, but also he's been great on the suppression of dissident voices, on lockdowns, which it's shocking how bad the Democrats were on that. So it's good for there to be a voice, at least nominally coming from the Democratic Party, saying this was all stupid and evil and pointless and wrong. So all those things are good. And I think also he has begun to, because of his alienation from the Democrats, he's begun to travel in circles that are more on the other side of things. I think he's probably realized these are not the demons I assumed they were. And so somebody like that, at least being in the national conversation, there's no way that's bad. And I absolutely welcome that.
Well, how many Democrats would come speak at a Ron Paul rally?
Yeah, yeah. Good point. I mean, it's a handful who would, but it's only a handful.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I am going to urge people. Look, I almost don't need to urge people. Look, it's Jeff Deist. You've read and heard him for years. You know that he is a font of original and interesting and completely convincing ideas. And now there's a Jeff Deist book. Well, you better go treat yourself. You can find it at tomwoods.com/2314. Once again, it is A Strange Liberty: Politics Drops Its Pretenses. Jeff, thanks so much.
Yes, and let me just thank Paul Gottfried and Tom DiLorenzo for writing intros to the book. That meant a lot.
Oh, yeah. The first paragraph of the Gottfried piece at the beginning is, you know, where he's saying that as I've gone through life, I've found that almost nobody agrees with me. But Jeff Deist may be an exception. I really, really like that. Yeah, great from Paul Gottfried and Tom DiLorenzo. Two really great guys. So thanks again, Jeff.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.